Chapter 35, Teardrop in the Door, Banquet.
Ye gods, it's amazing, better than a rose spa, Albon, the second valet to Kavik, says as a slender human-shaped robot massages his back with 15 translucent fingers sprouting from 4 hands. The robot's face and body are opaque white plastic. Beneath, a blue light pulses like it's got a mechanical heart beating beneath its assembly line shell. Is this what replaced my da in the mines? The personal travelling staffs of Houses Telemannus and Augustus lounge in a sitting room in Regulus Ogson's tower. Electronics and consumer goods litter the room. Basket gifts for all the staff, even me. He's the only man I've ever heard of who gives gifts to everyone else on his birthday. So what does Quicksilver want for this basket? I turn the attached card over in my hands. Lyria of Logolos, it reads in flowery gold cursive. For your unsung service to the Republic. August wishes, Regulus Ogson. Bribe or not, I cherish the card and rub my finger over the embossed winged teal.
As if you've ever gotten a message from a rose, one of Niobe's valets says.
I did one time, you know, didn't even have to pay.
Liar, you've silver dripping out of your ears.
Don't I know? Oh, gods, yes, robot, that is the spot.
Harder, sir?
The robot asks in a hollow human voice. Always, ow, ow, not that hard. Are you trying to kill me?
Impossible, sir. The first law of robotics states...
I know what it states, you toaster.
I sip my ginger tea, wishing Philippe were here to lend his wry opinion. My own is not needed among the servants. I'm still an outsider to this little club of valets. Most, except Albon, are in their 40s or 50s and have served since they were younger than I am. Their parents served, and their parents before them, just like Garla and the Docker Reds. Everything in Quicksilver's tower is shiny and sparse and silver and white, except the racing ships that roar out sound from a holographic projector on the far side of the room. Some valets and political staff sit there in tuxedos smoking or tapping away importantly at their data pads. Bethalia enters from the hall, speaking with Quicksilver's steward and the sovereigns, a happy plump man with quick fingers. Looks a bit like a giddy pig surprised to find himself in a tuxedo. We're here for Quicksilver's birthday. It was a sight as our caravan taxied in through the air to his skyscraper dock. Spotlights carved the November dark cycle sky. Onlookers with cameras filled dirigibles and rooftops. I watched out a staff compartment window from one of our armoured ships as the Sovereign and her son exited onto the silver carpet with the Telemannuses. For a moment, I felt like I was back with my family, watching the HC from 500 million kilometres away. The Augustans looked mighty fine, but I resented them all the same. This is their life, galas and parties. I feel guilty for that resentment. I owe so much to Kavix. The guilt dissipates when I remember the feel of mud, the sounds of the flies on my sister's body. They'll never hear that sound. None of these serious, pompous servants have heard that sound. I think of Philippe, feel the weight of his Bacchus pendant, and take comfort in the fact that I'm not alone. My data pad vibrates on my wrist. I hesitantly approach Bethalia and wait till she notices me so I don't interrupt her conversation. Yes, Lyria. Kavix pinged me. Should I go into the banquet? She adjusts my collar absently. Unlike the men, the women don't wear a tie. Our collars are stiff and high and without undershirt. Yes, but they're not at the main party. Cedric, could one of yours guide her? The other servants watch me jealously as I leave the room. I grin back at them for a little fun. One of Quicksilver's security captains, a tall, dead-eyed grey, guides me through the halls past lion guards. The woman has no interest in talking with me, so I return the favour. We divert to a small lift and take it down to a quieter level that's more darkly lit by lights that run along the ceiling. Water sweeps under the glass floor. Strange shapes swim through it. I try to stop and get a better look, but the valet tuts at me, so I hurry along behind her. She leads me into a large ivory door where several serious greys in tuxedos with Augustus linepins on their chests loiter outside, weapons bulging under suit jackets. Two obsidian men watch me from the shadows. I eye them warily, still terrified around their kind. They scarcely seem human.
"She's here for the fox," the valet says. "You class two citizen?"
The grey at the door makes me show him my ID. Another pushes open the door for me. Kavix's voice is the first I hear.
"Come now, Victra, Dancer is not so bad a creature." "He's a pompous, churlish, 3-inch backstabbing rat," a woman drawls. "A little rust-livered rat that has half the Senate eating out of his germ-infested hands." "You do not have to defame the man's honour," Kavik says. "He's still our friend." "You big idiot. Socialists don't have honour, they have psychosis."
The woman speaking is half-naked. A pregnant gold with jagged white blonde hair and a profoundly scandalous black dress with green spikes on the shoulders and a neckline that plunges almost to her navel. Trying not to look at her is like trying not to look at a burning house. A dozen people join with her in intense conversation in a sitting room with a glass-domed ceiling. Several servants bring them coffee and liquor. I spy Sophocles and pat my leg. He looks blankly at me, comfortable on Kavix's lap.
"Hear, hear," a rotund bald man says through his jowls.
He holds whiskey in his fist and has a ring with a gold eyeball in it. Quicksilver in the flesh. A picturesque pink man sits at his side, gently holding the stem of a wine glass.
"Sadly, the diagnosis is terminal for that lot."
"Does he really have 6 blocks?
Kavix's wife, Niobe, asks a grandmotherly pink.
"The coppers have not yet decided," the old pink says, glancing at another woman who stands with her back to the room looking out the window at the glowing city. "So we have 6 blocks, and they have 6, and the obsidian still won't talk. Who would have thought the war and peace comes down to copper?"
Kavix rumbles.
"I warned you of this, democracy."
He spits the word.
"Caraval told me in my office this morning that Dancer promised him a bill on low-colour and mid-colour reparations," the old pink says. "Reparations?" the pregnant woman says with a laugh. "It was a fine republic, a bold republic, until it went bankrupt in its 11th year because of socialist lunacy. They take the Senate, they'll gut the war effort to pay for their agenda, or they'll raise taxes."
"Or," the old pink says with a smile, "they'll do both."
"I'm already being taxed into oblivion," Quicksilver says. "How much more blood do they think they can draw from this stone?"
"I think you're doing quite well enough," Daxo says from behind his brandy.
"Well enough?"
Quicksilver asks hotly.
"Who the hell made you, Arbiter? Not enough you're blocking my acquisition of Ventress communications and curtailing the mechanisms of mines. Now you want to define when a man who built a business and a resistance army with his own two hands has done well enough. I had less trouble making Tino's than getting a bill through your squibbling Senate. Monopolies are bad for the people. Government is bad for the people.
Quicksilver makes a disgusted sound.
More regulations are bad for the people. You raise taxes, I have to raise prices. Little people get crushed.
Regulus Ogson, defier of tyranny, guardian of little people, Niobe says. How noble you are. I pull out a bit of duck liver that I carry with me as a lure for Sophocles. He stares on at me and lowers his head willfully to drink out of Kavix's mug. Damn fox. He best not make me come get him. I'll die if they notice me. Some already have. I've been too long in the room.
I say we kill Dancer, the pregnant woman says. I've 10 men that can make it look like an accident. 10,000 that can make it look like an example.
The old pink looks at the servants bringing them drinks.
Really, Victor, some digression. I'll buy a hollow billboard above Hero Center. I don't care, and don't act like they aren't your creatures.
You don't mean that, Victra, Niobe says.
Why not?
Because it's murder, and he's a hero of the Republic, akin to Darrow and Ragnar, she grimaces. Maybe more so these days. You can't kill him. He's the voice of Red. If he's murdered, the mob will storm the Citadel. We'll have an uprising, and not just here. Mars would disintegrate.
The Ash Lord would have a laugh at that, Kavix says.
Father is right. Might be his intention, Daxo adds. Darrow certainly thought so.
Ridiculous, the pregnant woman says.
I've just realised who she is, Victra Albarca.
Politics is such a bore without a little murder.
Honestly, I don't know how you people sit in the Senate listening to blowhard soft bodies yammer on about universal welfare at a time of war. I'd cut my gory damn ears off. Dancer is going to take the Senate, the woman at the window says. My heart skips a beat. I know the voice. Virginia, the Lionheart, turns around. My heart rushes under my sternum. Years of anger, resentment, now compromised by the subtle beauty of her, by the rolling power of her calm voice. The muted magnetism strikes me dumb, even as I realize she is barefoot.
He will take the Senate when we vote next week, she repeats. It's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when. Caraval will fold. He's just drawing this out to get a deal for his people.
And the Obsidians? Niobe asks.
Seffi will not meet with me.
What does that mean? Victra asks. I don't know. But we must assume it means we don't have their votes. So Dancer will have the majority needed to ratify the peace accord. 7 blocks to 6. Then I'll veto it. No senator will sit across the negotiating table with that bellona. It will pit the executive against the legislative. I'm afraid Darrow was right. This is a ploy by the Ash Lord to distract us. But Dancer will have to keep his flock of senators from straying. Well, I just have to mind myself.
Who do you think will cave first?
Me? Or a few senators? They laugh.
His momentum will run upon the mountain and founder.
Dancer is smart enough to know this. So the question that keeps me up at night is, where's the twist? How will he break the impasse? Her eyes settle on me, and I feel their massive weight, knowing I look like I'm eavesdropping. The others follow her gaze, and suddenly all are staring at me.
Lyria,
Kavix says, rising. He brings me Sophocles, who claws as he's handed over.
This little man needs to go piddly. Go on now, lass.
My cheeks are aflame. The most powerful of people in the Republic staring down a roster of Lagolos.
Now can we please talk about who the hell stole my ship?
Quicksilver rumbles. I finally let out the breath I'd been holding. I grab Sophocles by the collar and rush out of the room. My blood is pumping so loud in my ears I can hear no more of the conversation. The door shuts behind me. Directed by the valet, I follow a trail of golden footprints that appear on the floor toward the garden and mull over what I heard. Sophocles suddenly growls, his hackles rising as a small chrome globe, no larger than my fists held together, floats towards us in the center of the quiet hall. One of Quicksilver's drone sentries. I heard the valets talking about how he has no human guards anymore. Sophocles snarls at it as it draws closer. The drone floats politely upward to wait for me to pass.
Good day, Lyria of Lagolos, it says.
Good day, I reply with a laugh. Sophocles sniffs the air, less impressed, and then squats and takes a piss right in the center of the floor. A light on the drone glows red through its silver carapace. Bad, it says, and shoots a thin line of rancid liquid onto Sophocles. He yelps and darts down the hall. I'm pulled right along with him. Have a splendid day, citizen, the drone says. Damn robot, I curse as I catch up to Sophocles. In the garden, I freed the fox. He sniffs under the bushes, searching for the perfect spot. I sit down, still thinking of the sovereign. I've seen her from afar, but never been seen by her. Under her gaze, I felt she could hear all my evil thoughts, all my anger toward her and the Republic. She may have been larger than life on the HC, brilliant, perfect, but never once did I think about her as flesh and bone. She was tall, beautiful, but that's not the impression she left on me. No, the sovereign is tired. What would it be like, I begin to wonder, to be responsible for so many lives? Is that what you felt, Ava, when your children ran with you in the mud?
Who are you?
A voice asks. I jump and look to see a boy in a tuxedo sitting on a rock amidst the garden's trees. A hollow plays in his irises. I recognize his strange eyes and his dusty gold hair, and for a moment I think I'm looking at the Reaper himself. But he's a child, one I've only ever seen on the HC and from a distance. I look at the ground. Lyria, sir.
The Foxwalker?
I'm surprised he knows me.
I'm Pax.
I know, sir. It's a false humility introducing himself. He's the most famous boy in the solar system. The bloody damn first child. Heads as bare of sigils as his father's.
Sir, he wrinkles his nose, don't start with that.
I bend awkwardly at the waist, forgetting I should bow even though he's a boy.
Or that.
Sorry.
Can't be helped, it seems. Were you lot watching the race?
The race, I ask. He taps the corner of his eye. No, I mean, the others were. Don't know slag about races.
Really? Well, time for an education, I think.
I really should just...
Oh, Uncle Kavix can stand a moment without the beast.
He smiles sincerely.
Please, it'd be nice to talk about anything but politics. Mother makes me sit in on those little councils of theirs. Had to listen to Senator Caraval for 2 hours yesterday. That man can bloody damn talk.
I flinch. This is not his word. He pats the bench beside him. I awkwardly join, fearing what Bethalia would say if she walked in, but I can't very well say no. He switches the feed from his eye back to his datapad and then into the air. Ships suddenly fill the garden. The Cherry Racer is still out in front, darting between 3-star constellations suspended above the Hyperion cityscape. A pack of other ships follow in a tight line.
The Cicada Maxima, he says over the roar. I begged Mother to let me go, but she said it would be bad form to miss Quick's birthday and a security risk. He points at the Cherry Racer. That's Alexia Z-Rex, best pilot in the solar system. I thought Calloway Z-Char was the best, I say. The Warlock? Pshaw! You're brainwashed already. Pity. He examines me with a wide smile. I heard Char has 126 kills. If we're counting kills as skill, sure, he's good. Class to himself. But he's a gunslinger. Rex is a ballerina. Both outliers, both artists, but... Here, here, watch this turn. Most'll ease up on the accelerator so they don't crash into the wall. But they lose speed. She'll cut her rear engines, shunt power to her starboard thruster, and then pump the energy back to the rear, all without stalling or blacking out. Watch. I watch him. He's not like any boy I've ever known. He's aware of himself, who he is, who his parents are. I think he knows how nervous I am, so he goes out of his way to be kind, cheery. But if he really was so chummy with servants all the time, he'd be watching in the break room, not skulking here in the garden. But in the race, he loses the self-consciousness and the boyish energy bursts out, reminding me of my brothers. We watch as the Cherry Racer speeds toward a huge white pylon. Behind the pylon is a floating wall on the edge of the race course. All the other ships slow to take the pylon turn, but Rex's banks around the pylon, arcing like a kite on a tight line, and then rockets back the way it came, rounding the obstacle in a blink. Ho, ho, ho! Pax cheers. That's flying! His enthusiasm is infectious, and I find myself cheering with him. As the Cherry Racer speeds across the finish line several minutes later, the rest of the pack trailing far behind. So? He asks. She's good, I admit, but I still like Char. Because he's handsome? No, but he is. Maybe you think he is. Funny, then why? My brothers are in the Legion, infantry. Anyone who takes society rippers out of the sky has got my love. That's a damn good reason, he winces. Sorry, not supposed to curse. Don't tell Mother, it's not genteel. I'd be terrified to tell your mother anything, I say, trying to hide my bitterness with a smile. She can be a fright, can't she? She's really the kindest person you're likely to meet. Sophocles has done his business and is staring at me impatiently. I reckon I should get Sophocles back. That's right. Kavix might start weeping from separation anxiety. Kavix is a great man. He looks horrified. No, of course he is. He's my godfather. Well, co-godfather. I think him and Uncle Severo arm wrestled for it. There was cheating. Anyway, I was just japping. Where are your brothers stationed? He asks, joining me on my walk back. They're in the 8th, I say. They were on Mercury. Harness's own, he says knowingly. He's Arch-Legate, a Red General. They're in the Dune Cities doing aid work, I think. They said it was classified, he nods. Our secret? You haven't talked to them? Most of the satellites are down, too expensive. Because most were blasted out of the sky. He says it like it just happened naturally, not like his father led 10 million men in warships down onto the planet. I want to hate him. I have hated him. I hated him when he walked by his mother's side on the silver carpet and when I saw him on the news with all the photographers and journalists swarming. But it feels wrong now to have hated him. He's not so different than Liam, just a boy with circles under his eyes who misses his father and has to hide in a garden to find a moment's peace. May I ask you something, Lyria? He asks awkwardly. I don't know how to ask. Then don't. I know where you're from, and I've always wondered, because my grandmother and father won't tell me much, What's it like? The mines?
There it is. I keep walking. How did you know I was in the mines?
Father says it's important to know everyone's name and something about them. Not like a fact or something to memorize, but something real. I go over the new staff members so I can better understand them. And Kavik's mentioned you offhand the other day, said you saved his life. So I looked up your dossier.
My dossier?
Your history.
I stop walking. Then he knows about my family. Suddenly the attention makes sense. It's guilt, pity. All over again I feel sick and viciously angry at him in his perfect tuxedo with his white teeth and parted hair. Who is this little spoiled brat to try to bring my grief back to the light of day just so he can live like a peeping neighbour through my pain? My family didn't die so he could learn a lesson or satisfy his curiosity. What was it like? I murmur, turning on him and feeling the anger coming. Temper, temper, Ava would say.
Yes, they keep me in a bubble here. I want to understand.
Understand? He steps back from me and my cruel eyes. Little Gold wants to hear about the nasty shit. The cancer, the pit vipers. Maybe you want to go on about how they force us to marry at 14 so we can get to breeding, or how mine guards rape us for meds. They did that, you know, boys and girls. Don't show that on the HC for all you high colours.
I'm not a high colour, he says. I'm a red too.
White anger flashes. The fuck you are. You're just as gold as your da is. His face falls. And it feels good to see it, to know I can hurt too. I turn away from him, pulling Sophocles along on the leash. They all want a part of it, a part of pain that's not theirs. Nod their heads, wrinkle their foreheads. Now they want to pity it, gorge on my pain. And when they're done, or bored, or too sad, they whisk themselves away to stare at a screen or stuff their fat faces thinking, how lucky I am to be me. And then they forget the pain and say we should be good citizens. Get a job, assimilate. Maybe the Vox are right. They planted us in stones, watered us with pain, and now marvel we have thorns. Slag them, slag the lot of them. Stewing mad, I return Sophocles to the guards outside the conference room door, too sick in the stomach to face the hypocrites, and go back to the break room. I get so nauseous from all these low-colours buying the snake shit myth that they matter, pretending they're important because they shine shoes and carry capes and clone bloody damn foxes. In moments, I am back outside smoking burners on a balcony, touching Philippe's pendant and trying not to cry. I watch the cold ancient light of the stars and wonder which of them are already dead out there in the blackness. I miss my sister, my family, and though I speak to them still, all I want in all the worlds is for them to speak, to answer. Some proof that the veil is real, that they are not simply gone into the dark. But they do not speak to me. When the Augustuses and Telemanuses have finally had their fill of partying and conspiring, we depart. I slump along with the procession with my head down, crushed with guilt. Not just because of how cruel I was, but because I know a little prince with his feelings hurt will go and tell his mother, and I'll be sacked within the day. I feel Bathalia's eyes on me, and know she knows. I'm just as the other servants pegged me, a rusty bitch with mine manners, and no place in their fine company. The valets carried the gifts Quicksilver's given to our masters into the shuttle staff entrance. I follow behind with Sophocles' kit and my own basket, now almost forgotten in my arms. I see Pax and a mean-looking girl about the same age saying farewell to their important mothers. Both the Sovereign and Lady Barker are going back to the Citadel along with most of the staff for more meetings, and I'm bound for Lake Saline with the Telemannises, Sophocles, and the children for the week. I wonder if they'll sack me now or wait till we reach the manor. Probably wait. These ghouls hate causing a scene. Pax sullenly says farewell to his mother. She bends to ask him something. He shakes his head and leaves abruptly. On the passenger ramp to our shuttle, his eyes meet mine and he looks down and turns away. In my seat in the staff cabin, I look back over the frantic rant I typed to Philippe while smoking on the balcony. He hasn't yet replied. Odd for him to take so long. Did I scare him off with my ranting? You bloody fool. He's sick of you already. I want to send a message apologising, but that would look even more desperate. I glance down the aisle up to the passenger cabin. Sophocles sits in Kavix's lap. Pax takes a seat across from the man. Where will I go when they cut me? What will I do? Will Kavix send me back to Mars? Pull Liam from a school he's beginning to love, from friends he cares about? The thought of disappointing him crushes me. I should have just kept my mouth shut. I look back out the window as our ship rises up, signals its lights in a salute to the Sovereign's more heavily guarded caravan, and banks off to slither through Hyperion skyscrapers, heading north to Lake Saline. The buildings burn with lights and are as dense as the trees of the jungle outside 121. Water slithers along the ship window, distorting the lights and making the night seem like it's bleeding blue and green. Our escort's own lights blink rhythmically to the right of our ship. A strange red light blinks beyond them against the skyscrapers. It goes on, off, on. I squint and then discover it is not outside the shuttle. It's a reflection. I look down and through my suit's jacket a red light throbs. What's that? One of the valets asks, leaning to get a look from across the aisle. Lyria? I pull Philippe's necklace out from the neck of my jacket. Bacchus's silver face stares up at me, his gentle mouth pulling upward into a laugh, his face split in a grin, the eyes themselves blink red. The face of Bacchus begins to shudder and tremble like an animal is inside. Startled, I drop it and the silver splits in half along a tiny seam. From the seam, out of a hidden compartment, a dull metal disc the size of three thumbnails spins up into the air, inches from my face. It hisses, then darts away from me down the aisle, fast as a bullet. It reaches the front compartment before I even know what happened. No one noticed but the servant. Bomb! She shouts. The cabin bursts into chaos. Servants ducking, spilling drinks. Bethalia rising from her seat. Lion Guard standing to protect the passenger cabin. I try to stand, but my legs are ghosts of themselves. They won't work. They crumple under me, and I fall down into the aisle, head angled toward the front of the ship. Other servants collapse along with me till bodies litter the floor. Gas! Someone behind me gurgles. My own voice won't work. Lion Guards start falling as they rush to the passenger cabin. Lights flash in the ship. Gas masks fall out of the overhead compartments. But everyone has breathed it in already. Bodies are falling in the aisle, slumping in chairs. I've lost all feeling. Kavik swings wildly at the disc, smashing apart the walls in a frenzy to destroy it. But he's slowing, growing lethargic before he becomes the last to fall to the ground. Then there's a high-pitched scream from the device and a pulse like air being sucked in. The lights go out. Filtration units silence. Engines tremble no more. The drone falls to the floor. And we plummet from the sky. Buildings and lights and moving advertisement screens and avenues of ships flash past out the window. Our dead vessel spins sideways. Limp bodies flop and fly around the cabin. I slam against the sidewall, nose to the window, and see us passing through a layer of smog. We tilt again, and I'm thrown back into the aisle. Glasses and data pads and gift baskets whirl around the cabin. Then the ship jerks to a stop and gravity reverses. Debris and people float through the ship. There's buildings outside the windows, half constructed and missing their facades. My body hovers upward along with cracked data pads and the gift baskets. Then the suspension of gravity vanishes. Everything slams back down. The ship jerks downward again and crashes into the ground. Out the cracked window, I see a retracting door closing over the ship, shutting us off from the light of the city. We lie in graveyard silence. Then, a metallic sound echoes outside the hull, coming from the servant's passenger door. Something whirs and a stone-on-bone reverberation goes through the ship. A teardrop in the door begins to glow.
Chapter 36. Dinner with Dragons. Guests. Dinner with Dragons is a terrifying affair. We arrive after the Ra family has been seated around the low-lying table in a warm stone room that looks out through a glass wall over the plains and an escarpment of uncarved mountain. Oxygen-making ivy creeps along the walls and the domed ceiling, emitting a pale luminescence from white floral bulbs. More than a dozen Ra are in attendance. Rangy and austere even in their own home, they wear handmade rough fabrics of earth tones and sit rigidly on thin cushions around an ovular stone table, at the centre of which is a single floating orb of blue light. The table is the only furniture in the room, and the ivy the only decoration. Cassius and I join, both wearing dark Ionian kimonos and cloth slippers. There were no mirrors in my room to see how the clothing hangs. Ionian golds believe mirrors promote vanity and obsession with the self. It's a crime for even a low colour to possess one. "Of course, they don't want mirrors," Arja would say. "I've dogs handsomer than those rim dust eaters." To be fair, the Ra family is not beautiful by lunar standards. Their faces are too long in the jaw, as though someone took the clay of their visages and pressed them between a vise. Except for Dido, their skin is incredibly pale, their eyes slightly larger than desirable, their hair darker. On Luna, they would seem dour, cold creatures without proper refinement. But Serafina's words ring true. The absence of courtly behaviour and affectation has a brutal purity to it. Grandmother despised most of the fops at court, and while I know she was not fond of rim golds, she did respect their stubborn fidelity to the old ways. It is the reason why she had my godfather obliterate Rhea. The hardest iron cannot be bent, only broken. The serenity in the Ra's movement and the dignity in their conversation are more impressive to me than all the carver-enhanced visages and pompous exchanges of Luna's upper echelons. The family is not eviscerating the work of a new artist or lampooning a socialite for some faux pas. Instead, as we join, a quiet conversation debating the moral high ground between the Cyclops Polyphemus and the warrior Odysseus is underway. "Poor Polyphemus," says a young girl with wispy hair and dark-ringed eyes. "All he wanted to do was to eat his supper, but Odysseus had to come in and put out his one eye. He didn't even have one to spare, like father." "To be fair, Polyphemus did eat two of Odysseus's men," Serafina says, sparing a smile for me as I sit. "He's a lesson on how not to be a bad host." There's an empty space at the table beside her where a silver flower rests in place of a table setting, probably for her sister, 11 years dead but still remembered every dinner. It is not the only empty seat. Though their patriarch is missing, we're joined by the rest of Romulus's brood. I'm introduced to them. Young Palaron, a 13-year-old silent boy, his laughing delight of a sister, Thalia, the Polyphemus sympathizer, who can't be more than 9, and is utterly besotted with the color of my eyes, and Romulus's mother, Gaia, a desiccated old harridan with lava-pale skin, who drinks heavily and smokes bitter-smelling weed from a long pipe, which she clutches with spider-leg fingers. She does not touch her food and speaks only to the children in a wandering, frivolous voice. The rest of the table is filled out by Seraphina's cousins, including Bellerophon the Bold and his wife, a slender woman with large eyes and a trident diadem of House Norvo of Titan. The well-married man stares at us with pale eyes set in a sullen, cruel face. His long body is hunched like a praying mantis waiting for supper. Despite the earlier violence, Diomedes is also in attendance. He sits serenely at his mother's side and seems the favourite object of the children's adoration. "The heroes of the hour," Dido says with a smile to her family. "May I introduce Castor Aljanus and Regulus Aljanus, the men responsible for bringing our Seraphina back to us?" 2 bowls are handed to us. Dido stands, takes 2 pinches of rice from her own bowl, and drops 1 into Cassius's bowl and 1 into mine. Her family follows the same custom, each walking over to us to share from their own bowls, even Bellerophon, who flicks the rice with boorish contempt. His wife smiles apologetically. Last in line, Seraphina meets my gaze as she honours the rite and returns to her seat. I wonder if her mother knows she's visited my room, or if her claim of her mother's ignorance was a deception in itself. I didn't tell Cassius. He would think it some devious manipulation. Perhaps it is. I've not stopped replaying the exchange in my head. With rice before us, the meal is delayed, as per ancient custom, to demonstrate that the Golds are not slaves to the whims of their hunger. My stomach rumbles, but I dare not touch my rice. A violet with short cropped hair enters the room carrying a slender harp. He plays a gentle melody and is joined by one of the pinks from earlier, the woman with the ancient eyes and truculent mouth, Aure. She sings A Memory of Ash, a quiet, famous dirge written after my grandfather burned the rebel moon of Rhea in the first Moon Lord's Rebellion. No one ever accused the Moon Lords of having short memories. Without the buzz of the cosmopolitan cities of the core, it must be hard to forget. When the violet and pink have finished, they depart the room to light applause. Diomedes' eyes follow Aure in a way that he should hope no one in his family notices. I file it away for later. The main course of the meal is served without further delay by minute browns in dusky grey livery. Their eyes never rise higher than the knee of any Gold, but they are treated with politeness by their masters, thanked for their services and addressed by name. It's a civility I've seen in the halls and the hangars and the bathhouses amongst the colours from the top down, each colour within their sphere. There is no undue rudeness, coarseness or cruelty from grey to brown or gold to grey. I find it uniquely admirable, especially when I notice the children are not served by the browns, but must get up and fetch their food from a cart at the far side of the room. Servants earned with a peerless scar, I remember. The browns skip Cassius and me as well, until Dido motions them to serve us. We'll forgive the guests their naked faces for now. A small bowl of flowered water sits beside each place setting, along with a white linen towel. Recalling my lessons from my grandmother's steward, Cedric, I dip my fingers and dry them on the towel. The fare itself is as simple as the clothes, roasted fish from Europa with hearty seasonings of salt to mask the lack of pepper at the table. Flatbreads, hummus, plain rice, and roasted vegetables steam in unadorned bowls, which are passed around and served without utensils. The rice is in abundance, but the cuts of meat are meagre in size. "Regulus, the Archimedes is your ship, yes?" Dido asks. "She is. A sleek flyer who has seen more than a few years, older than Gaia even." "Hmm?" Gaia asks, looking up from her pipe like a dishevelled barn owl. "I said his ship is almost as old as you. You remember the line, I'm sure. A GD-17 Whisper-class frigate?" "Who is whispering?" Gaia asks. "No whispering at the table. It's rude." She goes back to her pipe and stares up at us suspiciously through a bramble of eyebrows, as if we mean to do her great harm. I've seen enough of intelligence to know how hard it is to hide. The woman does a fine enough effort for this backwater, but her guise wouldn't last the length of a gala in the lunar courts. The dancing faces worn there are the best in the world. Deception, the language of life. But it seems Gaia has everyone at this table convinced she is senile. Interesting woman.
Your ship is a rare craft for simple merchants, Bellerophon says coolly.
He traces a finger along the stone table. The man's a brutish clod with the petulance of a child. Devoid of mystery, a man must have dignity. I find the lack of either boorish.
Hard to see how it would come by legally.
I'm not sure I like your tone, my good man, Cassia says, but the pressure on your moon has befuddled my ears. Perhaps you might clarify so we might have no misunderstandings. Again with the antagonism.
Bellerophon scowls at him.
The rest of the Ra family look on with the faint amusement of people far too comfortable with violence to care much about verbal riposts. Seraphina raises an eyebrow and eats her fish.
He means nothing by it, Dido says smoothly. Do you, nephew?
Nothing at all. He stares on at Cassius. I won her in a bet 6 years back from a new money silver who couldn't hold his amber, Cassius explains now with a smile. She was liberated from rising sympathizers. Diomedes gracefully removes the bones from his fish with a single pull and shows Pelerin how to do the same.
Regulus, you said you served, he says without looking up.
I did. I was a centurion within the Augustan legions during the Martian Civil War. Diomedes looks up. Then you fell in the lion's reign. Respect fills his voice. The rest of the table listens raptly. Mention a battle, and their ears perk up like a kennel of dogs hearing a can open.
I did.
What was it like? Seraphina asks. Hell, Cassius says, disappointing them with his answer. He might not have fallen in the Reaper's reign, but it cost him his entire family, save his mother. It's a clever game Cassius is playing. By saying he's an Augustan man, he's one of the only core girls with the same sense of betrayal the Rim must have felt after the bloody triumph and the failure of their rebellion. A dangerous gambit. He might claim to know the same people, and some of them might have sought refuge here.
Did you know the Reaper? Diomedes asks Cassius.
I don't mind being relegated to the background. Grandmother thought talkative men the most hilarious of creatures, so busy projecting that they never notice anything until the jaws of the trap close around their legs. The key to learning, to power, to having the final say in everything, is observation. By all means, be a storm inside, but save your movement and wind till you know your purpose. It's a pity Dara and Fichtna Albarca were better students than the last generation of gold.
I did not know him personally, no. He was Augustus's lancer, Cassius answers.
Peerless don't socialize with men like me.
He taps his scarlet face.
Then you've come up in the world, Bellerophon says.
Did you ever see him fight? Diomedes asks.
Once.
They say he slayed the Storm Knight of Earth and defeated Apollonius Alvalii Rath in single combat. They say he is a true blade master, the heir of Arcus, that not even Arja Algrimus could stand against him now. The dark spirit in me bucks against that claim. I almost break my silence.
They say many things, Cassius replies.
What was your measure of him? Cassius shrugs.
Overrated?
Diomedes booms a laugh.
Diomedes is the Sword of Io, a blade master, Seraphina says proudly. One of six left in the Rim. He also studied with the Arcos on Europa. Became a storm son.
I feel a spike of envy.
Lorne taught me how to fish with Alexander and Drusilla, Diomedes corrects. His last student misused his gifts.
The understatement of the millennium. He had no desire to make better warriors, only better men.
In that he succeeded, Seraphina smiles at her brother. One day Diomedes will test the Reaper for himself.
Bellerophon watches as Diomedes humbly returns his attention to his younger siblings.
I smile at his jealousy and watch Diomedes with growing respect. We eat in silence for a time. I nurse the small fish on my plate. Cassius is already finished with his. Always a man of appetites. I'm more practiced than he in the art of self-deprivation at the dinner table. Doesn't feel so long ago that I was a knobby-kneed boy sitting at my grandmother's dinner table when she turned her long neck to me and peered down that peregrine nose and, in a kindly manner, inquired if I intended to sleep outside in the gutter instead of in my bedchamber, because by virtue of the fact that I'd eaten 3 whole tarts, I'd clearly abdicated being a man in favour of being a little pig. It was 2 days after my parents had died. I seldom eat sweets any longer. Cassius makes a show of looking around for more food.
Pardon the portions, Dido says, with a faint hint of apology. They're more conservative than you're accustomed to, I'm sure. We're in the midst of a ration cycle.
Thought you were sitting on a breadbasket here, and Europa is just one big sea. Or did you already eat all the fish? Cassius asks. I wait in trepidation. This line of inquiry is dangerous. An innocent observation that will lead inexorably to a casual inquiry about the new ships we've seen and the state of their docks and their stores of helium-3. I fear him asking that question. Dido smiles obligingly. On the contrary, the fisheries and latifundia have never been more productive. Then a lack of ships, I warrant. Many were destroyed by the Sword Armada, Dido admits, and there were lean years. But no, not a lack of ships or helium-3. In fact, it was disruption of agriculture on Titan last month that forced us to part with more of our bounty than anticipated. It isn't natural for her to tell us so much. A daughter of Venus must have found this place strange, I say diplomatically, trying to pull Cassius away from his obvious endgame. Ah, so you know my lineage. Aren't you a well-studied merchant? She says. You're rather famous, I reply, playing the overwhelmed youth. I spare a glance at Bellerophon, who has not stopped watching Cassius since he sat down at the table. Something is wrong here. I can sense the sharks beneath the surface. Even on Mars we know of Dido Al Saud. I doubt my father would let me still claim his name, she leans forward. Tell me, am I as famous as my husband? Seraphina tenses at mention of her father. She's barely touched her food and looks uncomfortable, furthering my unease. Few were as famous as your husband, I say to Dido. Her mouth pinches. How diplomatic. But on Mars, Romulus and Dido is still a fairy tale. A fairy tale. If only, she smiles at that. When I came here for the first time, I saw a foolish little sun creature raised in the court of Iram, a Gaja through and through. I fell in love with the pale wisp of a night and thought our life would be a poem. But once I arrived here, I felt the darkness, the cold my mother warned me about. I missed the sun and hated this place, hated my husband's austerity. He would fret over water left in a glass, a crust of bread uneaten. But then I learned one of Io's many lessons. Here, by darkness, by radiation, by hunger, by thirst, by war, we're always at siege. It is not like the world of my birth, where life grows on every rock and men eat until they vomit. On Io, scarcity makes us strong. It makes us value what we do have. She looks around at her family with a warm smile. Seraphina clarifies. Father set a decree 3 months ago that rations are in effect until reserves are back to appropriate levels. No gold may eat more, as measured by weight ratio, than the agricultural reds do. I'm startled. You mean to say even you followed the ration limit? Why wouldn't we? Seraphina asks, confused. It is law. Qualis rex, talis grex, Dido says. As the king, so the people. But you have power, I say, intensely curious. You can do what you like. Cassius shoots me a not-so-subtle look. He wants me to shut up and eat my food, leave the games to him. But my curiosity gets the better of me. My tutors called the Moon Lords impractical isolationists, but there seems little here but practicality. An errant claim, Romulus and I believe it important to teach our children to be more than just powerful. Dido slowly picks the meat off the bones of her fish with her fingers. Gold was meant to be an ideal to inspire, don't you agree? Why does she bait me? Cassius's eyes tell me to be careful, and so does Seraphina's. I'm just a merchant, I say with a humble shrug. My family wasn't like yours. Oh, please, don't be ponderous, boy. Peerless aren't the only ones with opinions. Pray tell, do you agree? Speak plainly, or don't speak at all. Were we meant to be more than just force? Weren't we meant to inspire? Yes, but then we forgot it. See? An opinion. She looks over at Cassius. You really should let him have a mind of his own, my good man. Sighing like that when he speaks his mind. Not good to quash the naturally inquisitive. She turns back to me. Now, Castor, it's been 10 years since we purged the sons of Ares from our moons and eliminated the last of the slave king's terrorists. Out of curiosity, how many rebellions and terrorist attacks do you think Ilium has had in the last year? 43, I say instinctively, based on the 10-year annual average of reported incidents before the fall. Seraphina's eyes narrow at the precise number. 2, Dido replies. Just 2, Cassius asks in surprise. A shooting and a bomb. The hierarchy has not changed. Do you know what inspires this loyalty to the compact from all colours? Honour. Honour in work, honour in morality, honour in principle and family. Our rules are harsh, but we obey them from gold to red. Romulus eliminated the rigged quotas in mines and the latifundia, has begun to phase out the obsidian gods, and makes each man understand he is part of the same body.
He has replaced subjugation with participation, given a reason to sacrifice for the betterment of all, and it starts with us at this table, the head of the body.
Each man and woman given liberty to pursue achievement with the best of his virtue and abilities, and rise within the station for which his flesh was made, a sacrifice of the self for the preservation of all. I murmur the words of the compact like scripture.
Admirable.
Yes, Seraphina says, her eyes warmer to me than ever before.
Why did you not carry on the fight? Why become traitors?
Diomedes has been nursing the question, waiting for a pause in the conversation. The timing is awkward.
You mean fight for the Ash Lord? Cassius asks, sipping his wine.
I think not. His daughter murdered my friends at the Triumph.
What of you, Castor? Dido asks. Don't you want revenge for your family?
I feel Cassius's gaze on me, the weight of expectation as I regurgitate his lessons, his maxims.
What good would it do? I answer loyally.
Is that your answer? Dido nods to Cassius. Or his?
How many times have I lain in my bunk on the Archimedes, lonely, fantasizing of strength, of revenge, of sailing home and taking back my grandmother's scepter, her chair, and putting Darrow and his rabid wolves in chains? I always thought it a fantasy, something that could never be. But now that I see how much strength is left in gold, how much of the old virtues, it grows harder to see it as the vain, idle fantasy of a little boy any longer. Gold is not dead.
Is that why you want war? Cassius asks. For revenge?
In part, yes, Dido replies. To avenge the wrongs the slave king has done us, but also to heal the chaos that he has made. His republic has had 10 years to create peace. They failed. The time is right for the society to be rebuilt. We have the will, the might, but we need the spark. That is why I sent my daughter to the Gulf, to retrieve that spark. Thanks in no small part to you, she brought it home.
She pauses a moment to smile with no kindness in her eyes. But now I fear it is missing.
Finally the twist, the reason behind all these innuendos and games.
Is that an accusation? Cassius asks warily.
Oh yes, my good man.
That's why you went back into the Vindobona, I say to Seraphina, but you didn't bring anything back with you.
I brought your razor, she says. My heart sinks in my chest. I missed it. I've walked straight into their trap. They've been toying with us, with me, and here I was admiring their civilization like a Goridam anthropologist.
And where is your razor? Dido asks. We're dying to know.
It was lost, I say.
Our hull was punctured and the razor pushed into space before the cellular armor could close the breach, Cassius explains.
Is that so, Regulus? Dido leans back.
The fish has left a foul taste in my mouth. I think it's time for dessert.
She motions to the servants and the door to the room opens. Two obsidians with bulging pale arms enter carrying a load between them, which they set in the center of the table. It is our safe.
Chapter 37. Lysander. Pray.
The safe was well hidden, Dido says, but of course our men are nothing but thorough. Fortunately, the cryptea who discovered it was one of mine.
If you are so thorough, then you know what sort of safe that is, I reply before Cassius can speak.
The safe might hold our damnation in our family rings, but it also is our only leverage. It can't be lost.
It is a Holson 7. It has 4 inches of rolled steel with an analog tumbler lock instead of a digital mechanism, which makes it impervious to electronic incursion. More importantly, it has 3 Sun Industry military-grade plasma charges embedded on the interior wall faces of the safe. You drill, it will detonate at a temperature of 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. But of course you know that. Or you would have already opened it.
Indeed, Dido says. Personally, I would very much like my daughter's efforts not to have been spent in vain.
She holds up a finger as I'm about to reply. And I would be wary if I were you at further insulting my intelligence by claiming your razor is not inside this safe. I bear insults poorly.
Then her lips slide into an enigmatic grin. But open it for me, and we can be friends again. I'm a most generous friend.
I glance at Seraphina.
Is that the only reason we're alive? I feel foolish for letting her lower my guard. A strain of grandmother's malice pulses into me, despising her attempts at manipulation.
Castor, let the adults speak, Cassius says slowly, his eyes fixed on Dido. The safe can be opened for a price.
A price? Seraphina laughs in appreciation of his boldness.
We are merchants after all, Cassius replies.
What is your price? Dido asks. For the key to your war, I offer a bargain. Give us our ship, give us our pilot, and any surviving crew members of the Vindobona. Give us our freedom, and once we reach safe distance from Aya, we will send you the combination. Dido wags a finger at him. Are you trying to make a fool of me? Caster left out a feature of the Holson 7, didn't he? Clever boy. A secondary detonation code, one that can be given in place of the real code. One you could supply me with when you're cruising toward the belt. And why would I want to destroy what's inside? Cassius asks. We take no issue with your war, only your value of our lives. Yes, she runs a finger over her lips. Why indeed? The silence grows to terrible lengths. On my honour, I'll send the proper combination, Cassius lies. He'd rather die than let them have their war.
Your honour, Bellerophon laughs at a private joke.
Be thankful we do not peel you like tank shrimp. They are guests, Diomedes says sternly. They have eaten our bread and supped at our table. No guest in the history of our house has been violated, not even the Fabii and the Reaper, not even the Ashlord after the burning of Rhea. Do not disrespect your ancestors.
Bellerophon rolls his eyes at his cousin and turns to his aunt. Ah, Dido, we don't have time for this. Vela is already rallying legions at Carath. If Vela escaped, then Cassius is right again. The coup is not concluded. The Codovan will be coming too. Our allies are nervous. Some won't stand by us if Vela attacks. We need the evidence.
Dido opens her hands to us. You see my predicament. There is no time for your proposal. One option remains, and that is to trust me. Have I not been a good host? Have I not shown honour? Does she think we're so stupid? Cassius smiles. You have my terms. Seraphine looks to me. Caster, no harm will come to you. My brother speaks for the both of us, I reply. Dido leans back in her chair and nods to a brown by the door. Tell Polybius to bring in his pet. Have you a new creature for the children? Old Gaia asks in delight. Her wrinkled neck cranes in anticipation as an old violet with a black moustache limps into the room. Oh, vile. She frowns as he carries in a glass jar filled with noxious yellow liquid. Something stirs within, but I can't yet make it out. The violet stands ominously at the end of the table. It is said that a life is made great by sorrow and joy. Dido stares at me, then Cassius. But you men are cursed. You will never really understand life because you do not know what it is to bear a child, to push a life from your flesh, to have two hearts beating inside you at once. She looks at the empty seat beside Seraphina. She takes the flower there between her fingers. To have had seven hearts beating beyond you, carrying your hopes, your dreams, and when one of those hearts stops, you feel it as if it were your own. She crushes the flower in her slender hand and lets the mangled petals drift free one by one to settle on the barren bones of her fish. The story of their life ends, all those dreams gone, and you begin to forget them. You begin to loathe yourself for time ill spent with them, for your grief stealing the joy their life brought as their memory begins to fade. More obsidians enter the room and stand behind us. My daughter, my Thessalia, was not made in my image, or Romulus's, Dido whispers. She was a birth of air, a sweet girl, a vessel of all my joy. 11 years ago, Thessalia went with her grandfather Rivas to see Mars and attend Augustus's summit. She wanted to see the Valles Marineris, the Olympus Mons. 11 years ago, she watched her grandfather die and felt fear as her head was caved in by a Martian boot. My joy vanished that day, and as a family, we swore vengeance upon all those responsible. Roch al Fabii, Lilith al Faran, Arja al Grimus, Adrius al Augustus, Antonia al Severus Julii, Octavia al Luna, Dido's lips curl, and Cassius al Bellona.
Chapter 38. Lysander. Grusley.
Cassius bursts from his seat, diving across the table to try to reach the access pad on the safe. The obsidians grab him and wrench him back.
I lunge for one of the knives on their belts, but Bellerophon stands and in one fluid movement whips his razor diagonally across the table. The thin black metal snaps around my arm. He jerks me sideways and I spill down, set upon by obsidians. Bellerophon's fingers move over the hilt of his razor to recall the whip to rigid form. He'll take my arm. Bellerophon! Seraphina snaps. Not that one!
He says nothing but flicks his whip free of my arm and recalls it back across the table. It slithers like a snake across plates and spilled rice. The obsidians shove me into my seat. They wrestled Cassius back to his. If you hurt him, I won't give you the combination, I say quickly. Seraphina, he saved your life. You're in his debt, and he's under your promise of hospitality.
Void because of your lie, Dido says. Diomedes, who has sat like some paragon statue this whole time, watching the drama unfold, now frowns.
Mother, I know the face of Bellona as well as any man. That is not him.
Oh, but it is, she says. The razor of a Bellona is in that safe, concealed under a shell of titanium.
I look to Seraphina, hiding my horror as I realize what gave us away. When she opened the razor to hide her evidence inside it, she must have discovered the false cover and seen the eagles on the handle underneath. She knew all along.
Did you think we did not know the technology of our enemies? Dido asks Cassius, gesturing at her own face.
You may keep your silver-spawned enlightenment. Here we have masters of the old ways, of flesh and bone. She gestures to the violet in his jar. You may begin.
The violet shuffles up to the table and, with a pair of tongs, reaches into his jar. From the yellow liquid he draws a tiny horror, a hideous spider-legged slug with corpse-pale skin and a belly riddled with small, hungry apertures.
This is a grizzly, Dido says. The creature squeals like a burning worm and writhes in the air over Cassius's face. He flinches away.
From its apertures, thin tentacles push past layers of pallid flesh toward his face.
The grizzly eats masks, you see. You're not the first spy to preach the gulf.
The violet lowers the creature onto Cassius's face. Black stingers spurt from the tentacles into his skin. It wraps its leg around his head and sucks, shuddering with an orgiastic sigh as my friend gurgles beneath its flesh. I watch in cold terror as the creature feeds till it is engorged and lethargic, and the violet pulls it back up with tongs to reveal under a mess of puncture wounds and thin trails of blood the swollen face of my handsome friend. He blinks through the layer of grime up at Dido as the obsidians haul him up to face our hosts. Blood and milky fluid drip into his beard.
The truth at last, Dido says.
Cassius laughs and rebelliously spits blood from his mouth.
Cassius, our Bellona, at your service.
I look to Seraphina for help, but there's no ally left in the room. She loathes Cassius as much as the rest of them.
You didn't just take my daughter, you took my brother, Dido says.
Marcus, Cassius says, the joy knight.
Your sworn brother, your fellow Olympic, you cut him down before you killed Octavia.
He was a bastard.
Yes, but he was my blood, she whispers. I will give you one last chance to open the safe.
Cassius grunts. So you can have a war that will send mankind back to the Dark Ages?
Funny, you don't look stupid.
These are the Dark Ages, Seraphina says.
We will bring order back, says the little girl. Have you ever seen a city after orbital bombardment?
I saw Ganymede after the docks fell from orbit, she replies bitterly. I've seen horror, starvation, a whole city frozen.
You haven't seen war. His heavy eyes strafe the rest of the Ra.
You all think you're the chosen people, the keepers of the flame, please. You know how many have thought that? You're just like the rest, too vain to realize the flame has gone out. The dream of gold was dead before any of us was ever born. You want a war because you think the Rising is vulnerable? Because they still battle the core?
You don't know Darrow. You don't know his people. If you attack, you lose everything.
The Slave King has already fallen, Dido says, smiling at Cassius's confusion. Of course, how could you know? He has become an outlaw. His own mentor and wife have turned their backs on him. The obsidian horde is thinned. The remainder stirs with discontent. Their senate devours itself and debates peace with the pixies of the core. They are flailing, scattered and weak.
The Ashlord has sought peace, I ask.
It seems war has softened his resolve. He is craven and will be dealt with once we have retaken Mars and Luna. Rhea will be repaid in full.
Dido turns her eyes to me.
They say your family is cursed, Cassius. How lucky you are to have a brother survive the Jackal's purge. Which one is he? Theseus? Daedalus? They would be his age by now.
She looks back to Cassius.
It doesn't matter. If you do not give me the combination, I will let our dragons suck the marrow from his blasted bones.
Cassius looks over at me with love and sorrow in his eyes. He's been searching for this for the past 10 years. A chance at redemption. Denying her war is that chance. It crushes him now to know the price it will cost. But he will pay it, I realize, even if that price is my life.
I swore to protect the people. That is what I will do, no matter the cost.
And do you share your brother's insanity? Dido asks me. Cassius would have stayed to free the prisoners on the Vindobona. He wouldn't have run at the first sound of obsidians like I did, because he is a hero and I am not. Whatever hate I have for Darrow, whatever hope these gold have kindled in me, I cannot betray Cassius now. I love the man too much, but it breaks my heart to know that the masses he would die for would have his head on a spike if they could.
He speaks for the both of us, I say again. Dido makes a small noise of disgust. She leans back, realizing the impasse, quick eyes searching for a way around it.
Diomedes, a blood feud needs resolution. Will you do the honors?
No, the Stoic Knight replies. She turns on him in confusion.
What? Dido asks, caught off guard.
You heard me, mother.
He killed your sister.
They are our guests.
You're joking.
You blathering idiot, Bellerophon hisses.
They're enemies of our blood. They are our guests. If you want blood, draw it yourself.
Let him alone, Seraphina says, standing. It is his right to refuse. I will do the deed.
No,
Dido says. Seraphina flinches. You doubt I can?
Yes.
Sit down. She ignores Seraphina's wounded expression and looks down the table.
Bellerophon, do what your cousin will not.
With pleasure. The man uncoils to his feet, long legs taking him around the table, till he stands looking down his crooked nose at Cassius's bloody face.
Beware, Milky, Cassius says with a feral grin. I'm a student of Aja Algrimus.
And I am the son of Atlas Al-Ra, sixth shade of the Shadowfall, slayer of Petro Albretta, the desert spear.
Bellerophon's eyes glitter with delight as he gathers phlegm and spits it onto Cassius's face.
It drips down Cassius's cheek, running diagonal with his peerless scar.
This is a blood feud. The blood of my grandfather and my cousin is upon your hands. Hear me now, you wretched worm. We are devils to one another. In the name of House Ra, I, Bellerophon Al-Ra, challenge you to single combat in the bleeding place till one heart beats no more.
Very well, my good man, Cassius replies with a brilliant smile. I am delighted to accept.
Chapter 39 Ephraim Lion's Den. It sounds like the damn world is ending. Clustered outside the downed gold shuttle, in the centre of our trap, Volga, Dano and I look up and feel the fear. Two escort rip wings chase after the downed Augustan ship. The blast door above us locks closed as the first round of gunfire pelts its reinforced surface. The shuttle plummeted a kilometre through the city, drawn downward faster than the speed of gravity by the fleet-grade Sun Industries Gravwell. The machine gripped the shuttle as soon as the EMP Kobachi built into the custom drone went off inside the shuttle. We almost lost the ship twice on the descent, as its rotation made it drift out from the Gravwell's projection radius. Dano wrangled it back by increasing the gravity to 4 times Earth grav. Aside from the shuttle, the gravity beam pulled down a deluge of rain. 7 flyers, a forest of shrubs from balconies, several clotheslines and 3 shattered hoverbikers, who died by smashing into the floor at 900 kilometers per hour. All that haul lies in a broken bone and metal soup around the shuttle in the garage of a half-completed Lower West Hyperion hospital. Dano kicks one of the shattered hoverbiker helmets away from the breach we've burned into the shuttle's hatch. The head is still inside. My stomach knots up. I'm back in the block war. Digging through debris, boots stomping over rubble and bits of men, gasping like a dying fish, lungs starved from the thermobaric burrow bombs that eat the oxygen out of the air. I tear my eyes from the disembodied head, thankful for my helmet so my crew doesn't see my horrified face. I didn't take the Zolodone tonight, afraid that the stomach cramps would knock me flat. I'm already feeling too much. The blast door shudders above us as the escorts pour more munitions into it. Soon it will buckle. We've 4 minutes before a rapid response team of Hyperion's counter-terrorism watchmen deploy from the 12th Cohort headquarters. Already there will be armoured bodyguards jumping from the escorts, searching for some other way into my metal trap. I stare into the mirage of heat as our breaching device burns a hole in the hull. Volga, armoured in a military-grade chestplate and helmet, pulls the breacher off and slams a steel and lead battering ram into the metal. It caves inward on her third swing. She tosses the ram aside and moves into the ship. The green magazine globe of her plasma rifle's barrel glows as she primes the generator. Dano goes in next. I follow with the omnivore in my trembling hands. If even one of the nasty bastards inside didn't get knocked flat by the anacine gas, this could turn into a bloodbath. Trig run through on a gold razor, men crumpling like cans to power hammers, ozone and burning flesh as the gold skins my team alive. My hands shake harder. The ship is upside down and black inside. It looks like a party gone wild, all the revelers having drunk themselves to insentience right where they stood. Bodies still buckled in their crash webbing hang upside down in chairs from a ceiling that was once the floor. Others are sprawled atop each other in a living carpet with eyes that shine like fountain coins up at me. We pick our way through the arms of servants and leather-faced killers in tuxedos. The Anacine 17 has made the muscles in their bodies, including their eyelids, unresponsive. Only their lungs and hearts still work, allowing them breath so shallow they look dead. There's no movement. My heart slams in my chest. We push for the forward passenger compartment in search of the prizes. As Dano bounces around the ship with a gymnast's ease, Volga and I climb over the body of a titanic gold with a red beard and almost step on a fox the size of a large child. It lurches up at us, snarling. I shout in surprise and kick it as it lunges. It flies down the aisle and onto Dano's leg as he hangs with one hand from one of the upside-down passenger headrests. He screams and falls down. "Get off me! Get it off!" He flails, falling to his back, and points his gun at the animal's skull, ready to blow its head off. Volga pushes the weapon aside and pries the fox's jaw open to free Dano's leg. "I'm gonna kill it!" Volga ignores him and grabs the flailing fox by the scruff of its red coat and locks it in the cockpit. We hear it slamming against the door as I haul Dano up. "What the hell was that?" Dano shouts into his comm. Blood dribbles down his leg. "Shut up. Work." Amidst a thick human shield of bodyguards and goals, we find the prize. "He's here," Dano says triumphantly as he limps forward. "The little shit is bloody well here." He says it like he doubted it. He's not the only one. The intelligence was too good. The plan too big, the stakes too high, the players far too nasty. Yet it's all slick and clean. Even I smile when I see the prize. The boy hangs suspended upside down, paralyzed and wrapped to his seat in crash webbing. Blood leaks into his hairline from a long gash on his forehead. He's smaller than I expected, no giant like his father. But still, at 10, he's almost Dano's size. He's dressed in a tuxedo with a gold lion clasp at his neck instead of a tie. His eyes stare at us in terror, limping and muttering curses to himself. Dano roughly cuts the clasp off, pockets it for a trophy, and then starts cutting the crash webbing as Volga keeps her gun on the paralyzed bodyguards. We pull the boy from the seat. Dano hoists him over his shoulder and carries him out of the ship as Volga and I find the secondary prize 3 seats up. The slender gold girl has a hatchet face and deep-set, angry eyes. Unlike the boy, she shows no fear, just absolute, unmitigated hatred. She's promising me a slow death with that look, as I cut her free of her crash webbing and cut the bleeding sun brooch from her jacket. I can't resist patting her on the head. Volga puts her over her shoulder and departs the ship. I stand alone in the dark vessel, listening to the thunder of their escorts against the blast door. Littered around me are the powerful and mighty who thought themselves untouchable, thought themselves gods. A dark, unexpected thrill shoots through me as I realize I've humbled the lot of them. I step atop the giant who the fox was protecting. The massive man has big iron on his hip. A razor, just like Ajar's. My boots smudge dirt and biker blood into his tuxedo. A Telemannus. I recognize him now. I turn to regard the cluttered cabin, wishing they could see my face and know that a lowly grey has driven them to their knees. "Reap what you sow," I say in a thick red Martian accent. "Give my regards to your masters, my good men." With a deep and courtly bow, paying all homage to gold manners, I hop off the Telemannus and dip my gloved hand in a pool of blood gathered around the head of a wounded bodyguard. I press the hand into the wall, leaving a blood-red handprint. Blame placed, I walk toward the passenger compartment. Time for the part I've been dreading. I find Lyria lying amongst three other servants who have the misfortune of being unbuckled from their crash webbing. One has a broken neck. Lyria stares up at me in the darkness. To her, I'll be a masked shadow, unrecognizable, with a glint of metal in hand. But I feel as if she and she alone can see through the mask. She'll know that Philippe did this to her, and she'll tell them. I can't have them piecing it all together. My life will be over. Make it clean. I point the omnivore at her head. My hand shakes. Sweat trickles into my eyes inside the humid helmet. She looks up at me blankly. Even in the darkness, she can see the gun. She accepts it. There's no wild fear in her eyes, just sadness. Resignation. Pull the trigger. Pull it, you son of a bitch. What's wrong with me? I've killed men in cold blood before. I was all professional when I explained the plan to the others. It needs to be done. "I'll wrap it up nice and neat," I said. "You can't pull a testimony from a corpse. Pull the trigger. It'll be quick. She'll feel nothing." I told myself I'd do it without the Zolodone, that I'd sack up, I'd own this. I close my eyes and see her little smile to herself back in that restaurant as she ordered that last flight of oysters. It was like seeing a child laugh at an adult's joke. So proud to feel accepted, but still self-conscious, wondering if their ignorance will be found out. Why did she have to smile like that? Like him. Fuck it. I pull the trigger. Nothing happens. I look down at my gun. The safety is still on. I almost throw up. I'm shaking, backing away from her, my stomach all tied up in knots, disgusted with myself. Idiot. Shoot her. Shoot her. I can't. Not twice. I holster the omnivore and turn to leave. I'm halfway out the door when I stop. I'm a bastard to leave her here alive. It's worse than shooting her. The Lionheart will peel Lyria apart. They'll think she's a traitor. What are you doing, F? What are you doing? I watch myself from a distance as I rush back toward her. She's light as a child. I carry her out of the ship and join my friends at the bottom of the ramp where our Junker hover car waits. Dano sits on the hood with a pistol in hand. "What the hell is that?" he says. I ignore him. He blocks my way. "This isn't part of the plan." "Shut up and get in the car," The hell's your damage, you old flit? Lose your stones? Dano reaches for his pistol. I'll do it for you. Wait in the car like a good little... I level the omnivore at him. I will shoot you in the fucking head. Get in the car. I step forward. No, Ruster. What? Dano steps back in terror, but not of me. I turn to see a hulking mass emerge from the hole in the ship, all shoulders and thighs. The Telemannus with the red beard slumps there, held up by his hands on the door, his legs butter from the anacine, his eyes filled with hate. I drop Lyria and raise my pistol. The anacine slows the man. He fumbles for his razor before giving up and lunging forward like a drunk bear. He hits me in the sternum so hard my vision flickers black. My gun flies from my hand and I'm lifted off my feet. I slam down into the floor, skidding into a wrecked flyer. From the concrete, I watch as Dano pulls up his gun and shoots the monster twice in the chest. The bullet goes through his tuxedo and slaps into the ship. It doesn't stop him. Stumbling, the gold reaches Dano. He grabs the top lip of Dano's chest armor, holding him still as the red claws desperately to escape. Then the gold swings a lazy punch. It hooks in from the right, casual, almost like an afterthought. The reinforced knuckles cave in the side of Dano's skull. His head lolls, ear touching the opposite shoulder. A white root of spinal cord juts upright into the air. Drenched in Dano's blood, the giant hurls Dano's corpse to the side and turns his horrible bulk to me. He takes an awkward step and is blasted sideways as Volga fires through the windshield of the air car. The plasma stream hits the gold in his side, melting through his arm and hurling him off his feet into the ship's hull. Volga rushes to me as I try to stand. There's a dent the size of a grapefruit in the center of my chest armor. Several broken ribs scream as Volga hauls me to my feet and drags me into the car. Torch the body! Get the girl! I say through gritted teeth. Volga stands over Dano's body and holds down the trigger on her rifle. Concentrated energy melts through Dano's corpse, leaving a steaming heap of crackling tissue and oozing bones. She rushes back to Lyria. The red girl issues horrible moans from her paralyzed throat toward the big gold man on the ground. Volga throws her in the trunk. She grabs my gun from the ground as I stare out the windshield, as the gold impossibly pushes himself up to his knees. The flesh of his right side melts off the bones. Anacine pumps in his blood, but he's still trying to stand. "Pikes!" he roars. The room vibrates as ships try to pound their way in through the roof. "Drive!" I shout at Volga. "Drive!" She jumps into the driver's seat and slams on the pedal. As we shoot away into the darkness of our escape route, we hear the door finally give and crash down into the garage. Volga drives at breakneck speeds through the half-constructed hospital, faster than Dano did in our practice runs. We weave between support beams and equipment as I stare out the back of the car, watching in terror for pursuing airborne knights. I hold my chest and wheeze like an egg. Dano's head caved in like an egg. After a kilometer of switchbacks and vertical elevator shafts leading to connecting buildings, we reach the staging ground in the abandoned canning warehouse and pull up in front of a makeshift clean room, metal frame pipes with plastic sheets enclosing it. I half expected a dozen syndicate thorns to be waiting for us with heavy weapons and Gorgo at their head. But they want to stay as far away from this shit show as possible. Our headlights illuminate Sira, standing nervously with the two needle-thin contractors I met two nights ago. They wear operating smocks, one a violet, the other a yellow. "Where's Dano?" Sira asks as she comes to greet us from her mobile station. A dozen holograms from cameras she placed fill the air around it. On the hollows, the hospital is swarming with soldiers come for the boy. The cameras inside the garage have gone black. Dead, I say. How? Gold. Shit, 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 Sarah says under her breath, as Volga drags the children out of the back of the vehicle straight into the clean room, where she loads each onto a table. Inside, the syndicate technicians move with haste. They slice open the children's clothing till they're naked. No, not children. They're killers in training. I know what they'll become. Ghouls that pop heads like eggs. Without even thinking, I pull out my dispenser and pop several Zolodone in my mouth and crush them between my teeth. They fizz, and I feel the cool fire spread against my tongue and the inside of my cheek, radiating into my blood vessels and carrying the warmth down into my body, sending chemicals to my brain to kill the fear and the pain in my ribs. I exhale a calm breath and look back at the car where Lyria lies inert. I turn my attention to the technicians. We are on schedule, but the schedule doesn't feel fast enough anymore. I shouldn't have wasted time in the ship getting Lyria. Dano's neck breaks again. I grimace and glance at the holograms. A flight of armored soldiers is landing around the hospital, just four buildings from where we stand. Hurry up, Sarah says to the syndicate men. Don't distract them, I say. Recheck the detonators, then get out of here. I don't have to tell her twice. Sarah's hoverbike whines as it departs through the escape tunnel. Only when I'm sure she's gone do I go back to the junker. I haul Lyria out and move her into the back seat of our clean car, a 10-seat taxi that sits next to the other rides. I take out our bags and dump our change of clothes onto the floor, then lean back in to speak with Lyria. Her big red eyes stare up at me. You've been drugged with Anacine 17. It will last another hour. I consider the Telemannus. He was four times her body weight. Maybe less. We're going to meet some very bad people. When the drug wears off, do not speak, do not move. If you do, they'll kill you. Afterwards, if you behave, I'll take you wherever you want to go and give you enough money to start a new life. On the Zolodone, my voice sounds like a robot's. It's a lie, I'm telling her. She'll be hunted forever, but I'll still give her a running start. She deserves that, at least. Do you understand? She can't blink or move. Hate is all she can manage. Good. I stack a bag on her face and cover the rest of her body. Even beneath the Zolodone, I know I will hate myself later. I know the look in her eyes is one I'll never forget. Add it to the pile. I strip my gear and toss it into a metal barrel and dress in one of my black quarterband suits. Volga, strip and burn, I say when she emerges from the clean room. She dumps corrosive acid into the barrel after she's stripped her gear. Found it? The yellow with a metal sniffer nose says inside the clean room. Right shoulder blade? The violet, this one with multi-hued chimeras tattooed onto either side of his neck, finds the mark, and soon two wicked-looking drills whir to life. Metal burrows into skin. The children whimper through numb mouths as the syndicate contractors dig out the embed tracking devices with forceps. Tears tumble out of the children's paralyzed ducts. The men toss the bloody little chips into a container. The baby naked and ready to roll, the violet says. Double check for radiation stains, I say, gingerly feeling my ribs. Don't be sloppy. After they've finished, the two operators shove the children into plastic smocks and then drag them out of the clean room. The knights on the hologram jump into the garage through the hole punched by the ships. The operators leave the children with us and depart in their own vehicle, taking it through a subterranean tunnel that links with abandoned tramways. Volga takes both children and loads them into the back of the taxi. laying them parallel on the seats as gentle as a mum tucking her kids in for a nap. She lingers there, looking down at them. Volga. She jerks her head up to glare at me and slams the taxi door hard enough to rattle the glass. Fuck you too, I say calmly. I leave her to go activate the timer on the explosive charges outside the clean room. 30 seconds starts ticking down. I activate the charges in the junker car, toss another next to the barrel for good measure, and hop in the driver's seat of the taxi as Volga tosses one of her charges into the clean room too. I follow the path of the syndicate operators down into the tunnels. If you gotta leave the field, do it in style, I mutter without heart. Soon as the old drill instructor's words are out of my mouth, the concussion of the charges going off shakes the tunnel. A second set of charges goes off a minute later at the tunnel's entrance, collapsing it behind us. We drive in silence, Volga pinched in the seat next to mine. The high of the heist died with Dano. Neither Volga nor I expected to survive this, and now that we have, the weight of living comes crashing down on the big girl. She rolls down her window and closes her eyes, sticking her hand out into the wind like it's a dolphin riding the waves. She sits 6 inches from me, but we might as well be worlds apart. Cold, fetid air from the tunnels rolls through the car. We pass ramps going down deeper into the undergrid of the city. The tension works its way out of my jaw, but the sight of Dano's blood on the fists of the gold oozes through my skull. Volga links her data pad with the taxi and turns on Ridovecchi. As his piano plays a gentle melody and we carve our way through the darkness, tears stream from her eyes, but not from mine.